This is General Nick Vaux, take two.
I first went to Ireland in 1970. I was in 45 Commando. In fact, I joined the unit after they had deployed to Northern Ireland. And I took over a company in a place called Ligonil, which was a mixed village, mixed community on the outskirts of Belfast. By coincidence, when I went back for an emergency tour just over 6 months later, I took over the same area. So I actually ended up serving there for the best part of a year, on and off, in the early 70s. Ligonil was predominantly Catholic, very poor, old, very poor old linen. I mean, there were two linen mills there, both of which were derelict by that time. And a lot of the area was actually rural, so we had a mixture of urban patrols and then operating in the fields and hedgerows. In those days, it was a pretty active scene. We were quite frequently sniped at. And I think just before I took over the company, one Marine had been killed and another had been quite badly wounded. So the sort of threshold of alertness and everything else was extremely high.
And this was sniping presumably from the Provost just
after. Oh yes, And this was sniping from the IRA. The other pretty dangerous. The other pretty dangerous thing that we frequently engaged in was together with many other companies, we were pulled in for the major riots in the Ardoyne, which usually took place at night. I think people sometimes forget. I remember standing on the roof of Ligonil Mill one night and listening to a sort of fairly typical battle going on down there. And the IRA were using automatic weapons. And it sounded just like a kind of, you know, small, or not so small, night fighting patrol clash in no man's land. And that was also the days when there were a lot more casualties on their side. I mean, it was not unusual for two or three people to be shot because they were using or carrying weapons. So there was a lot going on. The other thing that one always found very disconcerting was that the Protestants were at that time getting rather militant about the fact that in their view, they were being politically restricted and that the services didn't always support the cause in the way that they thought we should. So sometimes we actually had confrontations, though never actually more than a few stones being thrown and barricades being taken down. Nevertheless, the potential threat was very evident even in those days. By that time, community relations were virtually non-existent, simply because it was not reciprocated in any way. Yes, individuals would be friendly and be genuinely grateful, perhaps, as long as that was not observed by the rest of the community. So we had this rather peculiar system where we knew one or two families or individuals were friendly and we'd contrive a situation so they could talk to us without that being observed by the other side. But on the whole, everybody was truculent and very ungrateful for anything you did. I once remonstrated with the Mother Superior of a convent because the Marines were escorting her school children back into the Ardoyne and being abused in a very offensive way for doing it. And I reminded her that I'd ex-
stop that from being abused.
And we're being abused in a very offensive way by these little girls. And I reminded her that I was a Catholic and that I'd been educated in a Dominican convent. And she said to me, "That's nonsense. You are not a proper Catholic," she said. So that really was the kind of, I mean, there wasn't anything you could do that you felt was bridging the gap. And there was enough to do to keep law and order and particularly protect the Catholics against the real threat they were facing. I think at that time we felt in control of the security situation. We were in control of it partly because the threat was a great deal less than it subsequently became. And that was partly because it hadn't developed as it did do, became more sophisticated and more diverse. But the other point was that in those days, internment existed. And I feel that rightly or wrongly, prevented the threat from escalating the way it did subsequently. And we were very confident that if we lifted somebody with the necessary evidence, that he would be prevented from carrying out further terrorist acts, and he was. And later on, of course, that very much changed. Actually, when you arrested somebody, other than very swift and cursory interrogation, you yourself were not able to question them. And we did find that very frustrating because we knew what we were after at the time, and we knew the questions, in our view anyway, that was going to get you that sort of information. Subsequently, for the man to be interrogated by a policeman, perhaps, who wasn't even familiar with the area, seemed counterproductive to us.
It seems to be this, your 0.5 commander.
It's surprising how much intelligence you can actually amass quite quickly in an area, in a situation such as, say, Ligonier. And one does so by really the eyes and ears of the marine on the ground. If he's trained and stimulated to be observant, to be imaginative, to follow up something that he doesn't think is quite right, they'll gain an amazing amount of intelligence. And then I think what you've got to do is develop systems to collate and analyze as much of it on the spot as you can, because although a lot of it gets fed back upwards, and sometimes you'll subsequently learn a startling new angle as a result, usually it's what the backroom boys in the company or the battalion work out for themselves. The last thing is, you can gain intelligence even in the hostile atmosphere I've talked about if you just establish some sort of dialogue with the local community, so that even though they don't answer questions, the fact that they pass opinions or are hostile one day and then overtly friendly the next, there's got to be a reason for it. And it's a sort of intuition that is developed by having an ear into the community and what they're doing, what they're talking about, how they're reacting. So, yes, I think the British Army, in quotes, has learnt over the years to have a very acute sense of what the community in Northern Ireland is up to.
And again, we can go back to the...
It's been called the Section Commander's War because so often it's the corporal with a group, whether that's a section or a brick, as they're called nowadays, or whatever, who, and you know, an observation post, who is really the man who not only must detect something, but he's the only person who can make decisions in time to take advantage of it. And in that sense, the Northern Ireland Emergency has been a tremendous training ground for us all over this period of time. And it's no wonder that the standard of NCO in the British Army and the Royal Marines is as high as it is, because it's based quite a bit on that experience. There are all sorts of examples one can think of, but I suppose a typical one would be that we received some information on which we laid an ambush in one of the mills outside Ligonier, where we were told a bomb would be planted. In fact, that did happen, but in not untypical way, the IRA changed their minds about how they were going to do this, and they came in a completely the opposite direction to the one that we'd been told would be the case. So as a result, the whole ambush and the command and control and the springing of it and so on was suddenly, it was no longer possible for me to take charge, because I was at the wrong end. And so I had to pass it all over to a corporal, a Royal Marine corporal, who was the sort of corporal signaller. And he handled the whole thing quite superbly and was successful. But at the end of the day, he showed initiative and decisiveness well beyond that you would have expected of someone of his experience, a few years before the Northern Ireland Emergency. I'm glad to say he got the military medal. So, one of the tremendous limitations on operations in Northern Ireland is always this business of minimum force. I mean, minimum force absolutely dominates all the plans you make and the conduct of operations subsequently, and that's absolutely right. But I would guess that 75% of the any operation in Northern Ireland that's been a failure probably was as a result of this effort to minimize casualties and to make sure that the enemy, the IRA, was given every opportunity to surrender, and all the other restrictions, yellow cards and so on, that go on. I think in a way it's magnificent mental discipline and restraint for all concerned. And I think that was very evident in the treatment of Argentine prisoners, for example, in 1982. But even so, I would be a liar if I didn't say that there were many times when I'm sure we could have apprehended or killed a terrorist, but we were not able to do so because of minimum force. It's worth reminding people that you may never open fire except in self-defense, or when you are totally certain that the terrorist is about to carry out an act which will endanger life, i.e. he's about to explode a bomb or throw a grenade or whatever. And if there is any doubt about it, you may not fire. And as a result of that, a large number of people, I suspect, have lost their lives in Northern Ireland, been killed by terrorists because of this this legal limitation on what they may do. Whatever military solution means, will we eventually defeat terrorism and eliminate it? Then I don't believe there is one. If a military solution means, can we contain terrorism while political and social divisions in Northern Ireland are brought about, then I'm very confident, providing there's the will, that we can contain terrorism indefinitely. And not only that, but when I think back to the days when I first went there in the early 70s, and what Belfast or almost 90% of Northern Ireland is like now, there is no question about it. It has been largely restored to normality, and it's really only in certain small sections and along the border, especially, that the task still has to be carried out. Of course, the other thing about the military solution is that all of us believe very strongly that the people who must take the initiative are the police and not the military, because when the police are able to enforce law and order, I think then the public has confidence. That has been achieved, and I think the police force in Northern Ireland, helped also, of course, by the UDR, have made enormous strides forward. And we will continue to support them, I have no doubt, until the final aim has been achieved. I think all of us have an enormous admiration for the UDR. I certainly do. When one thinks that these are citizens who voluntarily risk their lives in the community interest, and they certainly do risk their lives, as the chilling statistics, which sadly don't seem to diminish, will tell. And I know half a dozen people in the UDR over the period of time I've been going there who have lost their lives. I think it's particularly impressive when you realise that we tend to go for a short, concentrated period to somewhere where we don't actually live, and then return and sort of carry, if you like, have a bit of rest and recreation and a different interest. But they are there all of the time. So, and I believe that the future of Northern Ireland in the long term is manifested by the resolution and self-sacrifice of people like that, both men and women too.